In your ballpark as Rabbanim.
I just got shyless from the rabbinate and the phone rang out. Graduate of the Kollel has an advertisement for his shul. We welcome all families, including interfaith couples. Could you imagine? This is a recent graduate with tremendous yichus. He's related to the Chafetz Chaim, among others. What? Anyway, the Shabbat they asked me, I paskin, you can't be if that's so. They're going to check it out. They're going to get back to me, but I'm shaking. Okay, today is Sunday, the 29th of April, 2012, and I get a mazel tov today, Baruch Hashem, a great granddaughter on Friday. Hey, Iyar. And let me tell you, that is a great achievement. Whether or not Yom Ha'atzmaut falls on Eiyar every year doesn't matter. But Hey Iyar is still, we don't say Tachnun, it is Hey Iyar. I just want to mention, this is very, very important, that Rabbi Benjamin Bleich, if you recall, we spoke about that Rambam and Kesef Shtav Abiyah Midivrei Torah and the Vatican. And it shows you, I have to thank my Talmud who listens via the website, Avi Arbisfeld, mentioned to Rabbi Blech that he never answered me. And he did send me an email on March 29th, and I'm sorry to say, I don't know what goes on in the office, but there are a lot that people claim they sent me, I don't receive them. A lot that I answer, people claim they never received, and I want to abolish email. And we should go back to the telephone and the horse and buggy. It would be a much safer world. Excuse me? Well, what does City Field have to do with email? City Field is a baseball stadium. Oh, they're having a keenness against the internet. Okay, I'm going to sign on with all the Gedolei Yisrael that your humble servant agrees. Anyway, I want to read the original. He resent it, and I want to thank Rabbi Blech for resending it. Yes, I went to the Vatican with Rabbi Asaf and a select group, 8 people in all. Was allowed to the library to see manuscripts usually off-limits. Which shown a Rambam manuscript, can't be certain what they told me is true, but one of the very oldest copies, and indeed it reads, Kesef Shtar Ubiya, V'kol gimel elu midioraitza heim. Amazing, unlike our text. Rabbi Asaf said in Yiddish to me, this is a revolution in Torah learning, and promised to tell the Lakewood Yeshiva world what we saw. Now, I don't know who Rabbi Asaf is, but evidently he has a connection with Lakewood Yeshiva, but if Rabbi Blech saw this, kol hakavod. That's all I can say. With Mitzitza Beper, I've gotten a lot of response, and people think I have power, influence. You know, they hear me on the website. They want me, why can't I speak to Satna? Why can't I influence them? It's zeal kriberavu. It's axiomatic. I don't have that power, and I apologize. I'm very moved by all my Talmidim who think I have this koach or this influence. But halavai, I should have influence on my own little classroom here. But I want to state that Yosef Chaim gave me an article by the father of a student of ours from the Kollel, Daniel S. Berman, a medical doctor, and he writes about Mitzitza Beper, is it dangerous, isn't it dangerous? And his article seems, he goes back and forth with all the, he would seem to be not opposed to Mitzitza Beper. So I want to tell you, all this article does, it convinces me all the more that Mitzitza Beper is asa, because I also understand that people who claim medical research shows that it didn't happen because of the Mitzitza Beper. They declared the coroner's report incorrect in New York now. But all this leads to one simple conclusion. Is there a suffix here? Once there's a suffix, it's pikuach nefesh. And that's what they asked the Revelvela, the Briska Rav. What do you mean by a suffix? Pikuach nefesh. And he answered, this is what I've heard quoted many times over. And he answered, even one millionth is already pikuach nefesh. And that's the attitude I got from my Rebbe in the name of Reb Chaim. So with all the respects to the article, it simply shows, of course, there's a lot written, but if the Chatam Sofer said what he did, and then all the way down to Rav Yashiv, and we're all in the same camp, how do you endanger a child when we're dealing here with at the most a minhag, but a minhag that really doesn't make sense, because the whole concept of Mitzitza B'Peh was to help the child recover from the brit. If that's the case, we have ways of doing it today where we don't run any risk whatsoever. However, there's one paragraph in this article for those of you that heard last Monday Shir, where I told you I'm very proud of myself, because what Rabbi Heschel was saying, I already reached that conclusion by 1975. And here I found a paragraph in this article, and I have to tell you, Daniel, if he is correct, I shiver and shake, because I thought it's only Rabbonim and it's only military leaders and only politicians who have come to an issue with a set conclusion. And look what it says here. First of all, it is difficult to draw valid conclusions from medical reports from the past. For one, it is impossible to check on the reliability and motivations of the author. And then he goes on. Boy, when I read that, I said, I'm in good company. Rabbi Heschel Shechter says what I said. Dr. Berman says what I said. But now imagine what we're playing with. You're playing with health. You're playing with medical research. And he says, we cannot check the reliability and motivations of the authors. So you see, a human being is highly, highly suspect. And again, I tell you with tears in my eyes, this is why the Musa movement failed. If you'd be a Musanik, I can't believe that you would go with self-motivation and prejudice. You would have to be totally honest. The Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, what I saw in my life, ugh. And yet look at the reality. It is frightening. And I told Yosef Chaim, he walked me to Mincha, I told him I had that experience this morning. I sent Feldheim. Feldheim wants my original contracts with them for the first edition of Silva and the second edition of Revel, and they, because I'm asking them for a release. Not that I believe I need it, but I have to satisfy the OU, whose lawyers are very mockpit. So I believe it or not, I not only dug up the contracts this morning. I had great success. I dug up sources I quoted more than 20 years ago. Someone in Highland Park, who I've never met, is my most devoted student ever. And if you go to the website, you'll see he's already, for 3 years of Shayurim on my Sunday class, he's put out Kuntresim with all the sources I quote outside of Shas and Poskim. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages. And he wrote to me that on Aguna, he was missing two sources, one from Hatzofer, Rav Gorin, and one from a journal from Tel Aviv where Rav Gadnavon wrote on fingerprints as a reliable source of identification. And believe it or not, I found the sources and I Xeroxed them today, and I have to check, but I believe that Sherry sent them on to him. So I had a lot of mazel coming up with the past. So I gave, before Pesach, I had the office send the sources an email with an appendix, whatever they call it. I'm using your language now. I haven't gone to Citi Field yet. And I don't hear anything from Feldheim. I go in this morning. The girl that shows me, yeah, my letter is in front of her. The appendices never came. So I said, why didn't you contact me? 2 weeks went by. I'm aftsaris. Be a mensch. Contact me. I didn't say a word, because if I say a word, she'll take what I gave her today, the Xeroxes of the papers that she needs. She ripped them up and throw them into the circular file. But I walked out saying, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, Rebbe, you are a failure. One out of a million can follow the dicta of the Musa movement, and that's why it failed. The Chassidish movement conquered the world. It's easy to be a simple chassid. It's harder to be a great chassid. That chassid you are. The Musa movement finished. Gentlemen, let me move on. Now, we're dealing here with, and you're going to see a crescendo building up. We're dealing here with such a fascinating question. What is more important, a tshuva or a psak halacha? And what can I tell you? When we have a shaila with Shabbos, and you know, there's so many newfangled inventions today. When I grew up, a blech was a blech was a blech. Today you have all these electric blechs. You have electric blechs with water in the middle. I don't know, all types of... you have electric blechs that are kli al gabe kli. And you have all types of inventions. What do you do, Shabbos? So, of course, I open up the Shmirat Shabbat, the Hilchata. It's a fabulous volume to use. I need not tell you, although the third edition that's just come out this past year is so heavy, you have to be a weightlifter to lift up. And that's only Kerek Aleph. We got to see more Krachim yet. So this is a book of Psak. You do this, you do that, you have footnotes. Reb Moshe is very different. When you open up the Igrot Moshe, you're dealing with a Shaila. And a Shaila may not necessarily follow what you see in a book of Psak. Yimitzarev Shitat, you're dealing with an individual. It could very well be that a Shaila being asked from Moscow has to be treated very differently than a Shaila being asked in New York City. I know that the Rav, I hear him out of the 1950s, I don't believe this applies today, but the Rav talking with Rabbanim in the 1950s spoke about Hilchot Tarat Mishpacha, and he said that he always tries his best if he can be maker when he gets a shail in Tarat Mishpacha, because he's overwhelmed that American women living in Boston are asking shailas in Tarat Mishpacha. So yeah, there's no question if you get a shaila about whether you can take the third Emmanuel. This was Takara Shaila, you know that years ago I spoke about it in the Kolel, because I mamish had Gilui Eliyahu here. When I was a kid growing up in the Bronx, the old timers used to talk about the snowstorm of 1885, and they used to talk about the fact that Reb Yitzchok Hanan was matir taking the third Emmanuel down to the east side to celebrate Simchas Torah if you paid in advance. And again, it's a different world, but the way it worked then was there was a turnstile, and you paid the I don't know what to call him, the gatekeeper. You gave him, two cents, and he opened the gate, you walked through. The turnstile opened and you walked through. What about if you give him the 2 cents before Yontif, and you know, you knew him, this Italian man or this Irish man worked the gate for years, he knew you, you knew him, and you said, Mr. O'Connor, you know that I'm a religious Jew and I can't carry money tomorrow, it's a holiday, 2 days from now, but I want to use the train to go down to the east side. Fine, I'm paying you now, no problem, Mr. Cohn. And Mr. Cohn gets on the train, and he gets on, walks through, Yontif takes the train down. No, the train is running anyway. I don't believe his weight affects the locomotive, affects the weight, and even if it does, it's a knapa shaila, whatever, we can look into it and come up with many, many concepts, lahatir, and the old time historian of Tzochana was matir. And I always, when Shol Stamfer did his research on Volozhin and Litter, his doctorate at Hebrew U, I told him, Shol, look out if you see any archival material, if there's any source for this. And he found nothing. And lo and behold, because I mentioned it in class and people were listening to the tapes, it's before the website, do you know that someone came up with it in a newspaper from the 1880s, that Reb Yitzchak Ochanan, exactly what I was told, and there was a tremendous outcry that you'd be mata using the third Emmanuel, it's the end of Shmirat Shabbat, people will use it on Shabbos, people will use it first day Yontif, and he was mata second day Yontif, Simchas Torah, you know, in the Bronx, it was very weak, how many good Jews were there in the Bronx? But the east side had the hotbed of the recent arrivals who still remember what Eastern Europe was. And there were endless shtiblach, and you could go and find, go down and celebrate. And it seems that the Shulchanim withdrew the Hetta. Now, of course, that Shaila came up again. I don't know if I write about it. See, I don't know what I write about. I don't know what I spoke about. I don't know, did I write about it in Washington? I don't know. But that Shaila came up again when my first trip to Russia. And they want to use the metro. There's only one active shul in Moscow. One, quoting communist words, one functioning shul. I want to use the metro. Can I use the metro? Can't I use the metro? And there's a way you buy a ticket. They had it all worked out that you sold the ticket onto your lapel. And even when March turns to April on Saturday, so you sew on two tickets, one that reads March, one that reads April, you buy a card in advance. And you show it. They let you through a gate. There were no lights that go on. Can you use it? So, of course, it's a big difference if the shaila is asked in Manhattan or if the shaila is asked in Moscow at that time. And this is why we have a dilemma here. Which is more important, the she'ela lahalakha or the psak? Not only that, even if you want to take the viewpoint that what the Chacham wrote last is what counts. I explained to you last week, we don't have dates. We'll never know the Rashba's opinion for sure on Hafkat Kedushin L'Mafreya. When I gave those lectures many, many years ago, I showed my class, I showed my Talmidim, I shiver after shiver, where he contradicts himself, and you don't have a date. And all that said, that the psukim are more important, the tshuva is more important, what he wrote last is more important, we are caught in a quagmire. And the sources differ, both in relation to the Rush, both in relation to the Mechaber, because when it comes to the Mechaber, his authority is overwhelming. When it comes to the Mechaber, anything he said, anything he wrote, whether it was lahalacha, whether it was a tshuva, whether it was in his Kesef Mishnah, whether it was in his Beis Yosef, whether it comes out in the Shulchan Aruch, anything he wrote, the Eidot HaMizrach, kiblu aleihem halacha lama'aseh. And what do you do when he contradicts himself? What do you do when there is a stira? And the debate rages on. And as I ended off last week, I showed you panim lekan v'panim lekan. Okay, now I want to come into the heart of the issue and come into your world. Just let me, 1 second. Okay. If it gets too cold, tell me, but we're at a time of the year where I'm wearing long sleeves yet, and perhaps it should be short sleeves. Okay, tell me if it gets too cold. Now, what is more important? Well, what really counts more? I'll give you sources later. But let's talk about why we should stress the tshuva. We already saw this when we spoke about the Maharil many, many weeks ago. A tshuva has one tremendous advantage. It is halacha lema'aseh. A rav, a Talmud Chacham, is paskening lema'aseh. It's not pilpul, it's not a shir, it's not lahadil Torah ulahadira. I'll tell you a story, and I know that Joseph Chaim listened carefully to the story, because there are very few people who can relate this anymore. And this is a true story. And I know that the person, I'll tell you his name, Henry Hurwitz, he's going to correct me and tell me, I'm telling me exactly as it was. I was not there at the time. I was in Israel. But Henry Hurwitz, who's the grandson of Sam Feuerstein, had a special relationship with the Rav. And they were learning Shabbos, whatever the story was. And they were dealing with the whole problem of going into an elevator and the guy, you know, in the big buildings in Manhattan that go all the way up, 20 stories, 30 stories, 50 stories. I already who spent the Shabbos at the home of the president of Fifth Avenue Synagogue. I think his apartment was on the 57th floor. And yeah, I don't have to tell you, he has it arranged with the what would you call him? The elevator man. Am I using the right word? Is that the word? What would you call him? The elevator man. I don't know if there's another word. He has it arranged to take him up. Can you? Can't you? Amira la'akum. And what does Amira la'akum mean? And even if you don't tell him directly, but it is Amira la'akum because you're getting in. He knows why you're getting in. Your very emotions are Amira la'akum. So the Rebbe is giving shir, and he goes into all the shita and shows that there's only one shita. I think it's the Sefer Itur. The Sefer HaTumah, there was one sheet of the Chuyah that you could be matir. But Ma'ika Hadin, the Rishonim were machmir. Fine. And then one Shabbat, Yi Hayom, Henry Horowitz's mother, who's a Feuerstein from the house. I mean, the Feuerstein is an elegant family that did so much for the Rav and so much for Torah and so much for Lakewood. It was part of that generation that they worshipped the Rav and they worshipped Rav Aaron Cutler. There were many people like that. Erwin Bunin is another example, where, as I said, they had two gods, Lahavdil, the Rav and Rav Aaron Cutler. So I know people who Talmidim of the Rav, who became big Lubavitchers. I once introduced one of them in the Kollel. He came in from South Africa, and I said, gentlemen, here is a rabbi who has two gods, the Rav and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And there's no contradiction whatsoever. So his mother goes to the Rav, and she had a shayla. She's staying on a very high floor. Can she use the elevator? And the Rav paskin lahatel. And Henry came to the Rav later that week and says, Rebbe, you gave us a shiur last week or 2 weeks ago, and you said this and that. And then my mother asked you, you said just the opposite. And the Rav responded, again, I wasn't there. I know that it's not the exact quote. And if you meet Henry Horowitz, ask him to correct me. I enjoy being corrected. But the gist of the quote is right here. What is with you? Don't you understand there's a difference between a shir, lahagdil Torah, lahadira, and a psak lahalacha? And this is exactly one tremendous basic reason why we should favor the tshuva. And I want to show you a source, a very important source, because it's from a very early period, the Radbaz, Reb David Ibn Zimra. Now, when you talk about the Radbaz, you're talking about someone who literally, remember we spoke last week about the Shulchan Aruch, about Reb Yosef Karo, does he have a din of a Rishon or a din of an Achron? The Radbaz literally is probably considered the last of the Achronim. He was in Egypt, he was the Rav HaRashi, letters, questions came into him from all over, he left 7 volumes of response literature as far as I know. It's a world of material. And I'm quoting Reb David Ibn Zimra, by the way, not to be confused with the Ridbaz. Many, many people make that mistake. It's interesting. I've heard that mistake so many times. Reb Yaakov David Ben Zev Volovsky is basically a contemporary. A guy named Rothkopf did postdoctoral research on the Ridbaz. He was chief rabbi in Slutz, then in Chicago, and then in Tzfat. He died about 95 years ago. And I know many of his descendants. I write about it in Washington. So people confuse the Ridbaz with the Radbaz. They're totally different people. One was Ashkenazi, one was Sfardi, one lived in Israel, Egypt, one lived in Europe, America, Israel. It's totally different people. But I'm quoting from the Radbaz, Shelitu Tshuvata Radbaz. This is a division that's called Divrei David. It has a name unto itself. Chelik Zion, I'm quoting, make it easy for you with Sheilah Chaf Hei. At the traditional printing, it's Daf Yud Aleph Omer Aleph. And listen to these words. Havi Yodeya Shafiluim Tietzeloma Shahachuva Hachi Chalukal Hapsak Al Hachuva Yeshlonu Lismoch Shehi Halacha Lema'aseh. Wow. Here you have from the great of the end of the Rishonic period, you have the Rabban. And the Rabban says, when a tshuva contradicts a psak in a halacha seifa, we go after the tshuva, because that is halacha lamaisa. And whoever the editor who put together the Tshuva HaRabbaz, we're talking about who put it together hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and he has a footnote at the bottom that yes, this is a question with the Tshuva HaRash, but he says what the Rabbaz is saying is that when you answer a Tshuva, this is the key of the Torah. Why was the Torah given? Lahorat Natan. Gadolat Tshuva Kedat Mala Asot Masha and King Bupsakim. Very fascinating. He has more of the sources here that I quoted earlier, but he makes one tremendous point. The whole purpose of the Psak is Lahorat Lama'aseh. You can learn Gemara, you can learn Rambam, you can raise contradictions, you can give a tremendous shiur, but that's not halakha lemaaseh. That's lahagdil Torah ulahadira. Halakha lemaaseh, that is more important than anything, and it is the tshuva, halakha lemaaseh, that counts and conquers any psak whatsoever. And I can tell you, and this was the problem with Brisk. All of you know who you've listened to, or those of you who have listened to my shurim years ago, I spent, 3.5 years on the history of Torah in modern times. So you remember what I explained, that Brisk revolutionized Torah learning. But when Brisk was finished, no one knew how to paskin. And this is why Reb Chaim, you all know, Reb Chaim insisted when he came to Brisk to succeed his father, the Beit HaLevi, who had just died, 1893, that they had to hire a dayan, an Av Beit Din, a great Talmud Chacham, Reb Simcha Zelig Riga, and he was from before Reb Chaim in Voloshin. He was before Matan Torah. He was like Reb Elia Prujana, Reb Elia Gut Feinstein, as the Reb. They knew how to paskin. They knew Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch by heart. But Reb Chaim wouldn't paskin. And the Litvishi Yeshiva, the Matzav, grew so difficult that following World War I, Slabotka organized a kollel for Psak. The top Slabotka students who were going into the rabbinate, they had to organize a special kollel for them because they wanted them to know how to paskin. No, give me a name of someone who came out of that kollel, who later taka was a great posek, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky. Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky learned in that kollel. Give me a name of a rav who helped administer the kollel and traveled to raise funds, and this may very well be what saved his life. Moyu Rebbe from Musa, Reb Yaakov Moshe Lacohen Lesson. He traveled, he wound up, he was out of Germany, he wound up fundraising, wound up in America already in the late 30s, he couldn't get back, and it saved his life. Of course, a good deal of his family was wiped out, part of his family was saved, it's the usual story, but he was traveling, and that was a kollel for Horah, and who ever heard of a kollel for Horah? But they had no choice, because if you left it to the Litvishi Yeshiva, no one knew how to paskin. And I can tell you, in Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Chanan, in my days, when we had a tremendous advantage over you, your yeshiva today, my colleagues, they may differ, but basically they may are echad. They all come from the same background. Rav Heschel Schechter, Rav Mordechai Willig, Rav Michael Rosenzweig, I don't have to go further, these are the leading lights. You'll take the younger Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Horowitz, Rabbi Simon, whatever names you want to add, I don't exactly know everyone there. They're all basically from the same background. But in my days, it was fabulous. Slabotka, Rotten, Brisk, Mir. And boy, did they fight with each other. You should have seen the tension under the surface. And you know, I was a naive kid. Why? This is why. Perhaps I went into Jewish history and I've been privileged to do so much research and publish so much and lecture so much on what went on in the Litvishi yeshiva. But we were exposed to it as kids. I don't want to go further. I already told you with Rabbi Volk and the Bulk and Rabbi Yochim Gerelich and the raftness of the yeshiva was shaking. But there was one Ungarische there in the yeshiva, Reb Shmuel Gerstenfeld. And they, from a von Ungarische, a Hungarian, he was the only one who knew how to paskin. The yeshiva, this is before RCA. Today, RCA has a baistin. They just issued a journal. This is the first journal from the RCA baistin. A Talmud of mine, his friend's son is the editor of this journal. It's wonderful, wonderful material. Okay, this is why you had a baistin. Who was the Av baistin? Reb Shmuel Gerstenfeld. If not to Reb Shmuel, no one knew how to paskin. The Rav ultimately had a paskin. He was a rabbi. Underline the word rabbi in Boston. He had to go in, as I write in my biography of the Rav, and Tobit Tolkien used to go in to the kindergartens of Maimonides with a lulav and an etrog. Maimonides was the only school that had school on Chol HaMoed Sukkot. You know why they had school on Chol HaMoed Sukkot? So the kid should have a chance to bench lulav and etrog and sit in the sukkah. That's what he was dealing with. Balabatham, the American reality, 1930s, 1940s. So the Rav willy-nilly had the paskin. He was caught in the quagmire. But the Av Beit Din was Reb Shmuel Gerstenfeld. And this is halacha l'maisa. It's not the shir, not the shir. In the shir, we can be mighty wise and mighty insightful, and our thinking process can be very attractive. But you all know, my biggest mistake in my first rabbinate, not what I write about in the book. All right, I got caught up in human conflict. I got caught up in the problems beyond my control. But I was an idiot. A balabas came to me. I had the same shiloh on the streets of Yerushalayim last year. A balabas comes to me, and not a Shem Shabbos or anything, but you know, yard site is a yard site. You know, it's that type of residue Yiddishkeit that either his grandchildren became Balei Tshuva or they're totally intermarried, but it couldn't continue. But this was the residue Yiddishkeit or the folk Malu Yiddishkeit. So he comes to me with a shayla. It's Ada Rishon Ada Sheni. When does he observe the yard side of his father? And I, like an idiot, tell him to observe both. It's a machlokes. I don't have to go into the Gemara Megillah, which is the real Adda. Is it the first Adda? Logically, it should be the first. Or is it the one that's closer to Pesach, where Purim is closer to Pesach? That's the real Adda. And there's a whole machlokes poskim, and a machlokes between the Sfad and the Ashkenazim. So it says, I think it's the Ramah, but you can look it up, that it's better to observe both. And that's what I answered this guy. This guy walked away thinking I was the biggest idiot in the world. And he spoke to me, you know, I don't blame him. He said, what a young rabbi, what a nut. He tells me to observe both. Look, today, if I had those type of balabatim, I would tell him either the first or the second. If anyone here will show me a source for saying Kaddish on a yard site, I will salute him. You understand what I'm saying? So you have to have a little understanding of what we're talking about. Okay, Minig Yisrael, fine. But the Tapaskin, that's nice and ishir. How do we view Adda? How do we understand Adda? Begin with the Gemara and Megillah. Take it into the Rishonim. Take it into the Achronim. Take it through the Psak Halacha. Oh, it's a beautiful shir. But the Talmud, all right, the Talmud's a tzaddik mela. He'll observe both your tzaddiks. Big deal. But we'll go to the cemetery place. It's Kibud Aviyim, no? What can I tell you? Hareini kaparet mishkava shalima shali. What can I tell you? I was just mekayim Kibud Aviyim. So, but to halakha maisa balabas, you got to answer. Either you can eat in Yom Kippur or you can't eat in Yom Kippur. Either you can use the blech this way on Shabbos or you can't heat up the soup on Shabbos. I got a shaila like that too recently, where they forgot to heat up the food. Oh, it was Pesach running into Shabbos. Don't ask the shailas that come up. Okay. Now, so halacha lemaisa is very important. That's one point. We're just going. Okay, Yosef Chaim, my dear Yosef Chaim, go ahead. The Rebbe has destroyed his life already. He's thinking of a little bit of the rap in it. Do me a favor. I don't want to have to say what I just said a half hour ago, that a Talmud of mine puts in his head, interfaith couples, welcome. And don't assure me you're not going to... 10 years from now, panasa, balabatim, a wife needs money. You know the difference between a wife and a car? With a car, it drains you. You can't say, you want to drive, you're going to need a new tire, new this. With a wife, you'll say to her, honey, I don't have the money. Boy, oh boy, I don't want to tell her about her response. At least the car doesn't talk back. Yes, Yosef Chaim.
Rabbi Mendel's asked one of the editors of the
Shibura,
did he pass it at all?
I'll tell you. Rabbi Mendel... Again, you hit me now with a soft spot in my heart. I described Rav Mendel in my book, and everyone who remembers him kisses me, says, you were Mekayim Tchiyat HaMetim. That was Rav Mendel. You can ask your father, Nachum. He would take the cigarette, break it in half, and you couldn't concentrate on anything because the fire was at his fingers already. And if you looked at his fingers, they were totally burned, calloused, that so much so he didn't feel the smoke, didn't feel the pain. So, you see, Rav Mendel was in the yeshiva. Again, I ask all those listening, quote me with understanding, that's all. He was there half-heartedly. He tried, you see, he came to America, the yeshiva saved him. Rav Shmuel Belkin was his Talmud. Rav Mendel came to America, so there by 1942 actually, I believe. And you should do the research on this. I mean, you should do something with your life besides the rabbinate. Recreate. So if you recreate the past, we have a future. So there were already B'nai Torah in America. And B'nai Torah in America, it's like on the east side of New York in the early 1900s. People came in from Europe who knew Shas and Poskim. They couldn't speak English yet. They no good at Yiddish. So they went to Yeshivas Pifkochana and they sat there 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and then they Americanized. By 1942, you had a nucleus of Europäische Talmid Chachamim from the biggest yeshiva, and they wanted to learn yet. They didn't want to conquer America. So they organized with Reb Mendel a Ke'en, a yeshiva in White Plains, I believe it was. Yonkers or White Plains, I think it was White Plains. You have to check. And it didn't succeed. That nucleus later turns to Rabarim, and the rest is history. They go to Lakewood, and I don't have to tell you what's doing today. Now, Rav Mendel, again, it has to be checked out that my memory is correct. For a while, he commuted to Toronto. And in Toronto, you had, as anyone from Toronto will tell you, the heart of the community was intensified 100 times over by all the East Europeans who came there. As a matter of fact, in Toronto, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, come out, every kid spoke Yiddish. Yiddish was on the streets. So there, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was there. Rabbi Reif was the Rav, of course. Now, the commuting was too hard for him. So Rabbi Belkin, this is Rebbe, brought him into the yeshiva. But he wasn't there b'lei v'nefesh. Rabbi Belkin wanted him to be... When Reb Moshe Schatz, because I'm revealing facts that unfortunately I don't know how many people are alive today who can tell you this. When Reb Moshe Schatzkis died, the Lamsha Rav died, Rabbi Belkin wanted Reb Mendel Zaks to become part of the ordination board with Reb Shmuel Belkin, Moriah Rebbe, Reb Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, and Reb Mendel Zaks. He refused. So he remained a bochen, he remained an insider-outsider, to paraphrase Herman Wolf. You follow me? So he didn't play a major role. I have to be honest, I was very close with him. But I was close with him because I was a good kid, I knew how to learn, I used to talk with him in learning. Then when I was a Rebbe, he'd give my class a bechina. And then one time he was very impressed because I had a principle that I never skipped Agada. I always felt that if you skip Agada, you leave a feeling with the Talmud that the Agada is not important, that it's not part of Shas, it's not part of Chazal. So I remember in Pesachim, whatever it was, I did some Amudim of Agada, and he was very impressed. And he asked the kids, these were 14, 15-year-old kids, and they knew. And we had a nice relationship. I went to visit him in Israel when I came in Aliyah, when I was here already. He came, I forget if he was here before me. I don't think he was here before me, but he came perhaps in the early 70s. He spent his final years here. So that's Reb Mendel. But to tell you, you're asking a good question. I mean, someone who knew the Mishnah Berurah personally and helped write it and helped edit it, of us at Mishkaken Paskening, but he didn't play a role. Rabbi Gerstenfeld was a YU person already. He read the New York Times. He was widely read. He could quote Shakespeare's Gevenen und Gadisha. He knew everything, halacha l'maisa. He didn't know Reb Chaim. He couldn't give a shir on Reb Chaim. I was just sat Shabbos with an old Talmud of Ravok. So he's telling me about Ravok and Reb Chaim. But then, Melech Reb Chaim Rabinovich, Reb Chaim tells, I said, you idiot, you haven't read my new book. Who'd I write that book for? I said, it's all in the book. He looked at me, what book? I tell you, I'm losing out. Washington to Washington. I want the world to know I make so little money on it, I will tell you I don't even get royalties. You have no idea how much the publisher makes, because it's not self-published. I'm an idiot. If I would have published it myself, I could sell it. Everyone would give me $100 shekel or $100, a gift. Rebbe, you deserve it. You know what my royalties were? After taxes, Baruch Hashem, maybe the equivalent of $400. It only cost me $250,000 to write the book. I stopped all my collegiate teaching 11 years ago. Forget it. But I wrote it for you. Those listening, please. It's worth the price, the pictures alone. And okay, so he's from Rabbi Rabinovich. Look into my book. Okay, now, when let me go further, yeah? No, what you're getting me wrong. Oh, so what happened was he opened the yeshiva. Exactly, it remains an elementary yeshiva today. It never succeeded beyond that. But when he opened it, there was a big, don't ask, this is not for, there was a big din Torah with the Chafetz Chaim yeshiva in Queens. Who owns the name Chafetz Chaim? So I have to say the din Torah came up with an ingenious solution. The one in Queens is Reb Yisrael Meir HaKohen, and the one on the west side is the Chafetz Chaim. And that has a branch in Muncie today with all types of problems. Keep me out of it. I amounted to nothing because I took Musa too seriously, and that's the end of it. Baruch Hashem. Okay, gentlemen, all I can do is love students with all my love, heart, and soul. That much I can do. Beyond that, I can't do anything. Thank God. But you're right. There were other Dinei Torah with the Mishnah Berurah. See if your father remembers. People were republishing, and he claimed that family had the rights, and there was all kinds of Dinei Torah. Don't ask. But one thing I'll tell you, Ktav, Bernie Shopstein, could do whatever he wanted in the yeshiva. He was a Talmud in the yeshiva. I don't know if he ever opened the Gemara, but he got away with everything. You know why? Because his parents had a storehouse for, I think they were already in the publishing business, they stored the printed editions that Reb Mendel did of the Mishnah Berurah. You understand, when you print, the biggest problem is, what do you do with storage? You print you do a run of 2,000. No, you sell 500, the rest sells slowly. They stored. So Bernie told me whenever Reb Mendel came in to give an exam, he automatically got a 95. One look at him, Shopstein? No. Oh, Ken Good. Gentlemen, go a little further. Another great Svadik Posek, Reb Moshe Ben Vinisti. By the way, you recognize the name? That's a name that until today you have many, many, many direct descendants. I was privileged to teach Ben Vinisti's, most of them Balei Tshuva, but this is big yichus. That Moshe ben Benisti shelet u'tshuvet penei Moshe chelik aleph siman yud bet. And here I have it xeroxed in front of me. 1 second. Yeah, here it is. Not easy to read. It's the old-fashioned rabbinic print where they run letters together to save money. And he also deals with this question, which is more important, and exactly this point. A tshuva is infinitely more important than a book of psakim. A book of psakim, you're learning, you're putting together ideas, the Rush is dealing with the Gemara, you're not dealing halacha l'maisa. This is l'hadir Torah l'hadir. It's like the Rav said to Henry Horowitz. All right, I gave it to you. Or it's like, I give you another example from the Rav. The classic example, I hear that until today, I shiver, I shake. When the Rav gave this tremendous shiur on why it's important to sit for Havdalah. With such lumbus, with Sudat Shabbat, and ending the Sudah, and Havdalah ends it. And that's why you have to sit. There has to be kfir. And you have to leave the Shabbos tablecloth on. You only take the tablecloth. My wife had to put up with me. My wife comes from background. Dara. I told her you have to leave the tablecloth on. And the Rav. And then a few weeks after he gives the shiur, the Rav is in the yeshiva for Shabbat. And we ask Rebbe, I still remember Reese asking, I can still see it right before my eyes in the Beis Medrash. Rebbe, Efshev et Yemachin Havdalah Fawns, the Kal Bet Achiz Machin, you know, we, the community is asking, you should make. And he's okay. And as he's starting, everyone sits down, 300 fellows sit. And the Rav, Vet Ach Gezak, Vet Ach Megala Given, who told you to sit down? Rebbe, you gave a shear. He looked at us. The shear is one thing. Halacha l'maisa, if he has to rub, to sit or not to sit, rub, what does your father do? People ask him with Kiddush. I mean, Kiddush is zil kribe rafu that you have to sit for Kiddush. Forget about Tosfot. Tosfot opens the door to the Hasidim. We're finished. Forget about Tosfot. The Rav, whenever Rebbe, can I sit for Kiddush, stand for Kiddush, vayichul, or what do I do? You know the Mishnah Berurah, right? So the Rav would always say, tell me what your father does. That's what your father does. That's what you do. Okay? And that's what he says. And he says, let me quote his words, that when you write a sefer psakim, the hachi rule of psak lalacha, v'rola masa. In other words, in theory, yeah, it sounds great, but this isn't lama'asa. Now, there's another factor here. I tell you, this is life. Shmuel, this is life before your eyes. There's another factor here. Gentlemen, when do you concentrate more? I want to ask you, Daniel, you have a difficult case. Whatever, you know what field you're going into yet? I can't hear?
Not sure.
Not sure. Okay, you have a difficult case. Let's say like my brother's field, ophthalmology. Tell me, when do you concentrate more? When you're reading a textbook or giving a lecture, right? My brother teaches in medical school, right? Or when you're dealing with the case in front of your eyes. You absolutely, I hope, will concentrate more when you're dealing with a real life patient. I know when I once fell and right here, thank God, I broke my hand in 4 places. And I remember when I would come back with the x-rays, the doctor wouldn't even look at me. All he's looking is at the x-rays. You know, it's like the patient doesn't exist. All right, but there I can understand it. But there's no question a doctor would concentrate more. He has to make a decision which can affect this person's vision for life. No, when you get a shayla, fine, I can give the whole pupil on whether or not you can use the metro in Moscow on Shabbos. By the way, this is not halacha l'maisa today, because today, Baruch Hashem, there are shuls all over Moscow, and you can do whatever. In Russia, they encourage you more for Yiddishkeit than in the United States. Take my word for it, because Russia is a conservative society, and there's still the old concept of a czar in Russia, as you all know. and it's the Putin's advantage to have as many good Chabadnikim and Shomrei Shabbos Jews there as possible, not like America, where the New York Times is on every street corner, including Borough Park today, and we pay a very heavy price for living in a dual culture such as Torah and the New York Times. No, imagine the question of a subway you can give a pupil from here to tomorrow. It's not segregation. It's not the Mikaven. You can go in and on and on. Segreshe, Lonichale. You can come up with so many different stories. But Halachul Maisa, when you have to paskin, you have to think hard. You have to think who's asking. You have to think what the implications are. As the Rav, I believe, told Rabbi Riskin, or so many others told Rabbi Riskin when he wrote that whole article about the Shabbos bus, it's the end of Shabbos in America. That's all the suburban synagogues have to see. If Prushim, Amatir, something like that, it's the end of Yiddishkeit. There's so many factors you have to concentrate. Moscow could very well be. I was told that Rav Moshe was matter for them, Rav Ruderman was matter for them, but they said they would not put it into print. I asked it at a later date, after I consulted with the Rav Shlomo Gorin and the Rav as per their request. But this has tremendous insight. When you're doing a tshuva, you're shivering, shaking if you're a responsible person. Because the student, the congregant, the devotee of yours is going to walk out and do halakha l'maisa what you tell him. And this is responsibility. And if you're a rav, you have to feel that responsibility. And it's just beautiful what he says about the tshuva dayak habeil l'chov svarato b'dikduk la'ashim tshuva la'ashoel she'yaaseh ma'aseh. And this is why the tshuva is so important. And then he goes into the achronim we discussed. What about that concept that perhaps the psak was written after the tshuva? And if that's the case, how can you say the tshuva is more important than the psak? And he says here, because when he's dealing with the tshuva, l'halacha l'maisa, he's more medayik. Maybe he's writing a psak, a general book. Doesn't go into all the details. Doesn't want to cover every exigency. I think when you're writing a book of psak, you don't want to be overly mekil. There are many times on an individual question, and we'll see this next year in great, 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 great depth, on an individual question, perhaps you can be maker. Perhaps you can be some kind of sheet of the Chuyah. Perhaps there are factors of Hefsid Merubah. But when that's a tshuva, you're not going to put it into a psak book. Because if you're overly maker in a psak sefer, what happens to Yiddishkeit? It's like a blanket with a child. You know what I'm talking about? Some infants become very attached to a blanket. You'll study this in psychology. You'll study this in all the books about raising children. So how do you get the child? I mean, the child won't walk away without holding the blanket. The child finishes eating, cries, wants the blanket. What do? Every day you snip off an inch, a square inch, every day. The blanket becomes smaller, smaller, smaller. 6 months later, the kid has no blanket, but it's not a trauma. Same thing with a sefer psak. You don't want to be too mekil, because once you're too mekil, Ribbono Shel Olam, one generation snips an inch, the next generation steps another inch. I don't have to go any further than the conservative movement. Anyone who knows what the conservative movement was and attempted to be, they're hitting their heads against the wall today. Who would dream? In Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, they forced the hand of the Chancellor of Shechters. It's 2 weeks ago. It's my student, David Galinkin. Homosexuals accept. Well, if you accept homosexuals, the guy who writes of patrilineal, and I don't blame him, he says, why don't the conservative accept me if they found a way to change the Torah, to drive the shul on Shabbos, and say that homosexuality is normative, why can't they say patrilineal is correct as well? Unbelievable. And this is why, even if the tshuva was written earlier, we will still be samach on the tshuva, because there he went out of his way to think before he paskened. Okay. Now, brings another proof, very interesting, why we always follow a tshuva. He says that with a tshuva, if you really wrote the psak book and you wrote it last, it should reflect the tshuvat. If you changed your mind, you should have corrected it. If you didn't correct it, it's a sign that the tshuva came after the psak book. You follow? In other words, if you're writing psakim and there's a tshuva that you wrote that contradicts it, if you changed your mind, then it should be also reflected in the psak book. The fact that it's not reflected would seem to indicate that the tshuva was written last, was written after the psak book. And that takes us back to what we saw in the Achronim, the Achronahi. This tshuva, or this psak, we know was last. Here he says, I can bring a proof that the tshuva was last, because the psak book does not reflect it. You follow? If you're writing a psak book and the tshuva was given 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, then your psak book should take notice of what you paskened. The fact that there is a contradiction shows that the tshuva came later. I don't know. I have to tell you honestly, I don't know whether that's a total proof, because, you know, sometimes in life, hold on 1 second, sometimes in life, it's hard to keep track of everything. I know that whenever you pick up an author's book, for instance, I'll give you an example. When I did my doctorate on Rabbi Dr. Dov Bernard Revel, who little did I dream at the time that he's my cousin, I only find that out 40 years later. But I had, and I have until today, the copies that he owned of his own publications. And you find endless scribblings, footnotes, corrections, addendums on the book. If you open up my copy of, let's say, the Rav, you'll see I corrected typos. One sentence I rewrote. I can't say I was wrong, but Rabban Soloveitchik questioned it. I don't want to go into detail now. So I fine-tuned the sentence. It was a fielder's choice. You understand that word? A fielder's choice. So I fine-tuned it. That way Rabban liked it, and Rabban Soloveitchik said Kathadik Levracha, and I was satisfied. It was a question of the relation with the Moshe's Bar Mitzvah. If I was right in writing, the Lashon was already closed. Technically, it was closed 1 week later, but there were no students left. Almost everyone was gone. Anyone who could got out. So how do you write it? So I rewrote it very nicely, which satisfied both of us. But I've never been able to make a correction because the publishers only want to make money, and if they have to make a correction, it costs money, what do they care? They keep on reprinting, what they have. It's not a serious problem for me on this particular issue, but it's certainly not a problem for them at all. So I'm not certain you can go by whether he corrected it, didn't correct it. Who knows? Maybe. Good luck. Do me a favor. Talk with me tomorrow about where you're going now. Something with a psychologist called me from America, Talmud, and he asked me something. I want you to check with Rav Bina. Okay? Talk with me tomorrow. And I'm not certain that's correct, but it certainly is a very interesting point. If he stated the tshuva before the psak book should reflect it. If it doesn't reflect it, perhaps the tshuva came after the psak, and that's another reason why we hold up the psak as being the ultimate, not the tshuva. Okay, what did you want to ask?
It should reflect his opinion, what he said in the Psak. And then you could say it's the other way around.
Yeah,
he's going at length and elaborating on everything.
You mean if the tshuva came afterwards, right, he should explain why? Yeah, I also thought of that, and that's why I'm not certain at this point it can be argued either way, but it has to do with the realities of life. The maelstrom of life is such that not always can you write everything, can you explain everything, and not always do you have access. Remember, these were kitvei yad. It's not so simple. But nevertheless, I would say the first reason certainly stands very strongly, that the tshuva is more important, because that is halacha l'ma'aseh. Okay. Now, different opinion altogether. Very fascinating. The psak is more important than the tshuva. And here you have from the Gedolei HaRishonim, I'm quoting from the Trani family, the Maharit, Rabbi Yosef Mitrani, the son of the Mabit, the son of Rabbi Moshe Mitrani. I'm quoting from Shevet Tshuvat Maharit, Morenu Harav, Rabbi Yosef Mitrani, Chelik Sheni, She'ela Zayin. And he's dealing with the whole question of a shtar. If you can be Mekayim, the chatimot of a shtar, shelo b'fnei balei davar. In other words, what's involved here is a machloket over money. And there's a document that is signed by witnesses. One of the balei davar claims the witnesses, these are false signatures, it's a false document. Lo aleinu, I don't have to tell you, we see this maisim b'chol yom where people falsify signatures, and even in our world, lo aleinu, how many religious Jews are arrested and charged and scandals and fraud. So this is the question. Can you be mekayim the signatures behind the back of one of the balei davar? Can the beis din act on its own? Or do they have to have the balei davar present? Now, why does it add to the shtans or to the aura if the balei davar are present? It's psychological. In other words, you're not going to lie, perhaps, in front of the person. To lie behind his back, ein adam neiz, right? It's a klal de Gemara, b'fnei bal chovo. Could be psychologically. You can maledict someone behind his back, and then he comes to me and says, Rebbe, is that what you said about me? And you say, no, you know, you want to double talk your way out of it. Could be a doctor, a patient walks out, this doctor was no good, he prescribed the wrong medicine, and the doctor calls him on the carpet. How did you say that? This is the medicine, this is fine, it healed you. Oh, no, I didn't say it. You follow? But when the person is standing there, could be, you can't be Mekayim the Shtar without his being there. And there's a contradiction in the Rush, how you paskin. And he has this question, and he paskins that the psakim are correct, that they count more than the tshuvat. And he says, Klalahu, the article Atum Hashanim Shal Sek, the Piskei Halacha Tamid, Shomer al Petach Beit HaMedrash, Shelo Yishalu Mimeno Deva Halacha. And he says, look, Tshuvat go on a whole lifetime. There is no end to the questions a rabbi will be asked. There's no way you can put guards in front of the Beit Medrash and say, do not enter, do not question, do not ask. Tshuvat will go on a lifetime. But if you change your mind, you should always go back. And that's what you just said a moment ago, to the Sefer Psakim and correct it. Make an addendum. Change it. Hayalo l'takein hadvarim b'mekomom b'chiburo b'shat shehumanein b'tshuva. To mistama einem meshe v'ele imkein amad al shashav shal dvarim mitoch chiburo. It's word by word. What was your first name?
Raymond.
It's word by word what you said. That when he's answering the tshuva, even after he wrote the Sefer Psakim, he should open his own book. You should look at your own writings. Doesn't Reb Moshe many times say, I discussed it in detail here, and he gives you the exact source? Doesn't Reb Avadji Yosef many times say, I discussed it in detail, and he gives you the exact source? If he changed his mind, he should have changed the psak in the Sefer Psakim. And this comes back to what we started this year with, dealing with that question we raised months ago. The Rambam on Kesef, Shtar, and Bia. And here you have the Tshuvat HaRambam, Reb Avraham Ben HaRambam. And doesn't Reb Avraham say that my father changed his mind and re-edited the Mishnah Torah, and in the final edition my father wrote the Shlosh HaDrakim, whatever the language was or is in that edition, Kulam made the Vrei Torah. So you see that, and he quotes this example, not the example of Kesef Shtar B'Bia, but he says in general, where the Rambam wrote a tshuva, he later changed the manuscript in accordance with the tshuva. V'kein the Rambam k'shanem otzim lo tshuva hafak mashaktu b'chibaro. Either he changed the manuscript, or if he didn't change the manuscript, it means he changed his mind about the tshuva. And he goes in here with the Rashba, Sefer Torah Pasul Shechaseba Otiyot Shematzinu Tshuva LaRambam Sheindu Mishum Bracha LaBatala Hefech Mima Shekata B'Chiburo V'yama HaRashba Demestama Hada Beimei Hashini. In other words, in the Tshuva he wrote, even if the Sefer Torah is missing letters, it's not Bracha LaBatala. And in the Mishnah Torah he writes that a Sefer Torah that's missing letters is absolutely pasul, and it is a bracha levatala. Contradiction. And the Rashbar interprets it that evidently he changed his mind from the tshuva, and what he wrote in Pesachim, that is his final opinion. Had the tshuva been correct, he should have corrected what he wrote in the Psakim. And he says here, V'nir Ali she'en davarim ela b'mekomam u'b'shaitan. And what does that mean? That you can't make an overly general klal, but each case on its individual merits. What do we know? What is the background? What How did he write it? When did he write it? What was his thought process? What was his health? Generally speaking, the psak went out. Had you changed your mind? Correct it. Gentlemen, we're coming into pay dirt. Hold on. Watch. Who is president of the state of Israel? I guess 1980s into the 1990s. President Navon, Yitzhak Navon. Know him? Turned 90 recently. I believe 90, maybe more. Interesting individual. Raised in Yerushalayim, comes from Gedolei Yisrael. Religious. Cum si cum qua. Traditional, Sfardic. He always complains that the Sfardic Rabbanim of today are too strict. The Rabbanim in his time, Gedolei Yisrael, Sfardic Rabbanim were not as strict. And Rav Kefet always adds, yeah, the Rabbanim weren't strict 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago, and look what came out of the generation who remained totally committed. The Rabbanim today are stricter, but Baruch Hashem, you see that there's much more commitment among the Sephardic masses. I may be right, I may be wrong, but one thing for sure, don't praise Rabbanim for being Mekilim. Where are you today? Where are your children today? Very fascinating individual. He writes, he was Ben Gurion's assistant. You know, Yitzchak Navon, generation moves on. He's written, he's a writer, he's a poet, he's a thinker. And all right, today it's a new generation and he's elevated to the status of a immortal. No longer real in the world. I mention his name and many bright faces are looking at me. Who is Yitzchak Navon? I once was taken out to a very fancy Moroccan restaurant where, believe me, I can't afford even to walk in because I think they charge you for breathing airspace. And hosting a whole group of heavyweights from around the world, there was Reb Yitzchak Navon. And if I'm not mistaken, they were not sitting on chairs. They were sitting on like little couches. What would you call them? What would you call hassocks? What's the word? For you put your feet on it. And they were sitting on it around the table, and it was mamish doner, a real Moroccan feast. Anyway, one of his forebears, Reb Yonah Navon, shelet u'tshuvot nechpa b'kesef, covered with silver, Ebenezer, chelek sheni, siman chaf zayin. And they're dealing with a classic Aguna case. And here's a woman, her husband is missing, no one knows his whereabouts, and she's an Aguna. And suddenly a guy comes along, a Mechalos Shabbos, an Ochlein, a Velet, and Tlefat, Pasul, the Eidot. And he sees the rabbis are trying to find out, and no one steps forward, and he steps forward and says, no, I saw this man, he was killed by highway people. Can you believe him? And of course, we have a cloud that you even believe a Gentile, but it has to be Mesiach Lefi Tumo. You know that expression? Halakhic expression? That he says it without prejudice, that he had nothing, no axe to grind, I would translate it. If I'm walking along the hallway, and I give you an example. When I was teaching in YU, when I started teaching in the early 60s in YU, so I remember I'm walking along the hallway and it's a Keren Zavit. You come to a corner, the students can't see you and you can't see them. And I hear there was always a Shaila, there was Drake's Cakes. Do they still have Drake's Cakes today? So then it was under Rabbi Raubach. So it was always a Shaila, can you eat Drake's Cakes? And I hear one kid say to another, if Rabbi Rothkopf can eat Drake's Cakes, so can we. And then we bump into each other. So I told the kids, it's not me. I asked Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, and he said to me, That much you could be samach on Rabbi Raubach, was Rabbi Raubach senior, the Rabbi Raubach today giving the chash happens to be my Talmud. So it's a son, but all right. These kids raised the serious issue. But meisich lefi tumam, you follow? Serious issue? Can you eat Drake's cakes? And if it shows you your responsibility. If you're a Rebbe eating Drake's cakes, students will eat Drake's cakes. Know what you're eating? Okay. Believe me, Drake's cakes, if they're still around, I believe they have an OU today, OUD if I'm not mistaken, and there's a bestseller, and I believe Rabbi Raubach is now giving Heksha, I don't know what the company is called, but it's a rival to Drake's cakes. They're very similar cakes, half the price. All right? I hope it's a good Heksha. Don't want anyone to say to me it's half the Heksha. I believe it's a good Heksha. So, Meisich lefi tumo, you can believe someone. But what about where he hears the rabbis talking and it's not Meisich lefi tumo? And there's a machloket haposkim. And he gets involved with the Sifrei Psak, with the Tshuvot, and there's a contradiction in the base in the Rabbi Yosef Karo. And what do you follow? Do you believe them? Don't you believe them? And here he says the psak is infinitely more important than the tshuva. And the reasons he gives, as if they stepped out of any rabbi's diary in the year 2013. We are at this moment, Raymond. Unbelievable. What's your problem? 2013? Raymond, never forget this. Eizah Chacham, Haroeh et Hanolad. You don't say a word without thinking what the implications will be 1 year from now. 2013 it is, my boy. Raymond? What he says here is unbelievable. I'll paraphrase it, then I'll read part of it. Gentlemen, it's what I alluded to last week. Remember the story I told you with Rabbi Albert? When you're asked a question, people are bothering you. People want an answer. People think the rabbi knows everything. And even if you're the greatest Talmud Chacham, people don't realize there are questions that border on life and death on Mamzei Rutan Aguna, Chilul Shabbos, Tafers, Chametz and Matzah. These are not questions of Yom Tov Shemini. It's a very, very uptight, tremendous responsibility. They want an answer. They have no time. When you give a tshuva under those circumstances, it's not good. When you write a book of psak, you have all the time in the world. You don't have to rush. You can think. You can research. You can consult the Bar Ilan computer program. The world is at your fingertips. You put it all together, you're a genius. Took you a month. But no one was breathing down your back. You did it for menuchat hanefesh. Can I teach you a Hebrew word that the Muslim movement used, Rabbi Yisrael? Metinut. Matun. Gradually. How do you say? What would you say? Matinut means? I don't even know. What? No, it's not the Matinut. Slowly, surely, gradually. You don't get excited. You don't jump. Wow. Let me quote it to you. Lefi, the tshuva are more important. The psakim are more important, the psakim are more important than the tshuvat. Lefi shehein devarav yoteh biyishuv. Bishrashay Hadinim. You can analyze the sources. The way Mishaya miss a lovely kacha tshuva, and no one is hacking you ahead. Give me the tshuva. Lafamim hadam lo yachol hamikarui im hamihirut lachashin sho alau dava. If they're pressing you, quickly come, answer. You just can't think it out. And I want to tell you, this is a major reason, not a minor reason, why the psak, the svarim, are infinitely more important than a tshuva, even if the tshuva is halacha lema'aseh. What you go through with balabatim, what you go through with pressure, what you go through with endless phone calls, today would be emails. Rabbi, why haven't I heard from you? What's the answer? What's the matter? Why do you have to consult? People are waiting. Our reputation is at stake. The family, they'll leave the synagogue. What pressure? Sefer Psak? No one's pressing you. Fascinating. And finally, gentlemen, you just saw Svadi Posek. Nechpa Bakesef, Rav Yona Navon, the great Navon family. You should know that the Ashkenazi Posek of the United States of America, before Reb Moshe, makes exactly the same point. And even more than that point, here there's a reflection of what Torah life was about in the United States. And of course, I'm going to quote from Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. Now, Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin wrote a number of svarim, but perhaps the main halachic sefer he wrote was not written as a sefer. It was written as a fundraiser for Ezras Torah. Ezrat Torah, or Ezras Torah, as we pronounced it in America, was organized in World War I, or right after World War I, to support destitute rabbis in Eastern Europe and in Palestine. And Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin was the executive director, the fundraiser, was an unbelievable individual, a tzaddik yisod olam, and he was the biggest posek in America. Baruch atah melech olam she'kol yemei ro. Was the biggest fundraiser in the United States. He put out a luach in honor of the 30th anniversary of Ezras Torah. What does it mean? A luach dealing ikari din hagim medinim u min hagei beit hakneset. If you'll turn to page 167, and you can find this in two volumes that were put out about 10 years after his death, Kol Kitvei Hagon Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. If you turn to page 167, the bottom paragraph, you'll find something unbelievable. Gentlemen, how did rabbis make a living in the United States before, I would say, 1950? Most Orthodox Rabbanim, certainly the Europeish ones, the European ones, lived on handouts. They didn't get a salary. People came into the shul was a shtibbel, the shul was a Beit Medrash. Well, people contributed to the rabbi's support. Purim geld, Chanukah geld, Mechilat Chametz money, we'll come to that next year in the Monday class, in a different context. Mechilat Chametz money, a funeral oration, Siddhi Kedushin. That's how a rabbi made a living. And it wasn't an honorable living, and it was a difficult living, but that's the way Rabbanim survived until modernity took over, and YU graduates, and shuls, and salaries, and it's a different world today. No. The more you saw the rabbi, the more psychologically you would feel an obligation to pay him, to give him something, for Hanukkah, for Purim. And in order to avoid seeing the rabbi, people would telephone the rabbi anonymously with halachic questions. And no one could understand what Rav Henkin wrote without my little introduction now. Because look how it begins. V'lo yafeh osim eila ponim b'sheilot al yedei ha-telefon u'malimim et shmam u'mekomam b'chdei liftor et atzman milisa me'ol rabbanut she'yitztarchu lisa k'she'yifnu panim b'panim. Wow. Can you understand what I just read? What is he talking about? It's not nice. Funny way to begin a paragraph. It's not nice, these balabatim who turn to a rabbi anonymously and ask him questions because they don't want to see the rabbi face to face. But with my introduction, Raymond, do you have it? Avoid seeing the rabbi, you don't have to cough up money. And these were poor Jews, schnurrers. Barely made a living. Not today. It's a different world today, thank God, on that level. In many kehilot, I can't say all. In Israel, we have real problems, and it's now heading to a crescendo, much quicker than I thought it would arrive, but we're there. The crescendo has arrived, and Rakefet is the happiest shoter or katan in the world. Everything I predicted came true, word by word, so quickly. Gentlemen, Rav Henkin is furious with these people. Because he says, when you ask the rabbi face to face, I'm quoting him, he has time. He can look at Svarim. He can decide what to paskin. And he knows who's asking him. And if he wants to change his mind after he did more study, he knows who to contact. But when you answer the telephone, you don't know who you're talking to. And once you give an answer and you hang up, even if you want to change your mind, even if you want to alter your psak, all you can do is whistle. There's no way to contact Mr. Anonymous. You have no address and you have no phone. And here you've paskened and you've changed your mind. And this is a terrible feeling, because many times we all make a mistake at the first response that comes our way. Wow. And he says, if you're going to use the telephone, at least leave the rabbi your name and address. So if he changes his mind, he can send you a letter. We would say today, when I was growing up, leave your name and phone number. Today, of course, 20 years ago, it would have been leave your name and fax number. Today, it's leave your name and email number, which you won't get anyway. Because it gets lost along the way, and the poor guy who sent it has confidence it arrived, and the guy is eating chametz on Pesach because the rabbi answered incorrectly the first time, and then the email is floating in cyberspace. What a world you guys live in. My condolences. Gentlemen, what insight, what understanding, what a psak of Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. And you can see he's in total, total agreement with the Nechpa B'Kesef, with Rav Navon. And there's so much to be learned from this. And I always have a principle. If someone asks me a Shaila, I have to know who it is. And I do my homework. It rarely happens that I change my mind after I've done my research and given an answer, But I take Rav Henkin's advice. He was a fabulous posek, an unbelievable individual, totally committed, b'lev v'nefesh, to Ezra's Torah. The stories are, for me, not legendary, because I lived them. For you, they're legendary, how he made something like a chveis, $46 a week, and when they wanted to give him a raise, the $50, he made a cheshben and said he only needs $48. That was Rav Henkin. He raised wonderful children, and as you know, his grandson is Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, Shivat B'nai Banim, who we quoted in great detail in our Monday class. Gentlemen, I will only tell you the most insightful and the best is yet to come. You will never forget next week's Shir B'ezrat Hashem. And Matan, get your gun back from the army. You're to come into class with your gun so we can illustrate what we'll be talking about. That's number one. Number two, oh man, you guys are wise guys. But let's be certain. Nathaniel, married? When are you going to get married? What day of the week will it be? Where will you get married? Where are you fishing to get married? What, are you going to run off to Baltimore and leave us desolate? What's so funny? Gentlemen, Nathaniel will be getting married Friday afternoon at the proper time in Yerushalayim. And we're going to talk about that in great depth. Oh boy, you won't forget next week. Gentlemen, tomorrow I show you that Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein turns Aaron Lekefed into an absolute moderate. And if I have time, I'll tell you what Rav Shalom Gold did to me Yom HaTzmut night. He ripped me to shreds and called me a liberal Jew without any feeling for the real halacha, be it a tshuva or a psak. And boy, am I happy after last week Rav Heschel Shechta turned the Rav into a kanai and Rav Kefet into a dove, a liberal. Tamara Rabaran is the kanai. I'm the liberal. And if time allows it, Rav Shalom Gold is the right winger and I am a liberal dove. What a pleasure. No one can chop my head off for being a right-wing fanatic for a change. Gentlemen, what did we do today? We went into real tshuva hudir. What's more important, the tshuva or the psak? And ein hachinami, you can go back and forth. There's so much common sense involved, so much life sense. And you know, when all is said and done, I think the only answer is there's no answer. It depends upon the question, the circumstances, the people, the time, the situation. A big difference in writing a tshuva at a time of war or if you're writing a tshuva at a time of peace. V'day l'chakima b'remusa. Again, we gladly accept the email from Rabbi Benjamin Bleich, and it's an extremely important email. And I don't know who this Rabbi Asaf is and what his connection is to Lakewood. If anyone knows, let me know. But if this is correct, they saw it. It solves endless halachic questions and problems. Halavai, we can see a photograph of the original manuscript. If anyone wants the article on Mitzitza B'Peh, you're welcome to it. Does anyone want another tradition article? Is it still circulating? Do you need another one, Danny, or, excuse me? Yes, it's, okay. Here's the article. Okay, and this is for Yitz Rubin, who's not here. In 2 minutes again, tomorrow at 9 a.m. in Health and Happiness. Das Vedanya. Thank you very, very much.